There we go. Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy discussion of Sir Thomas Malory's Mortdarthur. This is our fifth session, only about one session-ish behind my initial schedule. We're good. Tonight, we are going to talk about the adventures, or as I have called them, the misadventures of Sir Balin. Balin is the most unlucky knight in the world. He is the only character I know of in literature who kind of makes Turin Turambar look like he got a good deal, actually, I think. And the reason I say that, I'm not saying that, you know, Turin Turambar ended better than Balin or something or had a more fun life. What I am saying is that I think that Turin Turambar got a bigger shot, right? I mean, He had chances, right? He blew them, but he had chances. I'm not sure Sir Balin does. But anyway, we will get to it. I've always loved this part. There are a couple reasons. I love the story of Sir Balin. It's a tragical story. Very tragical. Though in some places it becomes so tragical that I can't help but laugh. And I just, the activities of Merlin during this book are absolutely my favorite. These are my favorite Merlin moments in the entire book. So I've been really looking forward to talking about Sir Balin with you guys, or Balina with you guys. So, but first, let's do a couple quick announcements. First, and most urgently, I wanted to make sure to remind everybody that our fall semester at Signum University is starting soon. We are starting in about a week and a half now. But there is still time to get involved if you want to take one of our courses. We have a bunch of really fun courses. If you go to our homepage, signumuniversity.org, and scroll all the way down to the bottom, you'll see the list of all of our courses that we're offering right now. And they're awesome. So if you would like to take some courses in our newly approved master's degree program in the state of New Hampshire, because, you know, we got approved and everything unanimously and stuff by the Higher Education Commission at the beginning of August. So anyway, that's I'm still kind of excited about that, I have to admit. But anyhow, it's really fun. But anyway, like I said, there's still time. So even if you're not in the program yet, we've had a couple people submit applications here in the last, this week here. So there's still time. We're pretty quick in processing applications. So if you want to start, totally. Now is an awesome time to start. But anyway, so yeah, we're on the move here at Signum University. The other thing that I wanted to mention, the other thing that is big that is happening right now is we are entering our moot season, our regional moot season. Of course, you know we've been increasing our regional moots and doing our small activities here and there around the country in order to be able to just have more opportunities to connect with folks. I have been so happy with all the regional moots that I've done. We've been to the Midwest, out in Iowa. We were down in Texas. I was out in London. We've done lots of fun things. This year, we have even more new moots scheduled. So we have four of them coming up in just the next few months. So Bay Moot, of course, is happening, well, like the day after tomorrow or 2 days, it was this weekend, right on Saturday. One other thing I wanted to mention, by the way, since I'm going to be out in the Bay Area this weekend, and actually since Worldcon, the huge science fiction convention, is also happening out there, I'm going to pop down to San Jose and visit folks down there who are down at Worldcon. So if you know anybody at Worldcon, or if any of you are going to be at Worldcon in San Jose this weekend, I can forgive you for missing Bay Moot if you're going to Worldcon. But anyway, I'm gonna pop down, as I say, to San Jose and catch up with folks. So, but anyway, Bay Moot is going to be awesome. I can't wait for Bay Moot on Saturday. That's going to be awesome. But there's more. There's way more. So we have four other moots. So five moots already scheduled, and several of them already open for registration. In fact, Bay Moot is, registration's closed for that one. But the other four that are upcoming are all going to have the registration open very soon. And they are Middle Moot, our middle of the country Moot, which has sort of meandered down to Kansas City this year. So going to be a great time in Kansas City, Missouri this year. That's going to be on October 3rd. No, 6th. October 6th, the first Saturday of October. And then we're going to be going out to Los Angeles, LA Moot, on the 27th of October. That's definite. You can find all the details at lamoot.org. And then we're going to be down in the South. We're going to do Magnolia Moot in Charlotte, North Carolina on November 10th. Then we're going to have a little break during December. No scheduled moots in December at this point, but we're going to be coming back in January for Tex Moot. It's our second annual Tex Moot, which is going to be also shifting a little bit. We were in Fort Worth last year. We're going to be in Waco this coming year. So that's going to be that you can, look, we've got a website for that one, texmoot.org. You can see the call for papers, by the way, already on both the LA Moot and the Tex Moot websites and stuff. And of course, the call for papers is also there on the Middle Moot website. Lots and lots of stuff coming up. So those are the ones that are definitely scheduled. We're also working on several other things kind of in development still, not fixed on for dates and stuff yet, but we're working on a New England Moot at long last up here where I live. We're working on a Seattle Moot. We're working on something in New York. Yeah, awesome. And yes, I see a volunteer in the Twitch channel to help coordinate a Seattle Moot. And that's a good thing that you said that, actually, because I was planning to email you about that. So I'm glad you said that. So I'll be in touch soon. It's on emailing you is on my list, actually. So that'll be good. But anyway, yeah, and we'll totally as we get towards those, I would love to, I'll send out through social media and stuff sort of announcements. And anyone who wants to help to volunteer, it's a lot of fun. It's great to have a sort of a local on the ground team. Organization teams of these moots have been great. We do a lot of support of these. We have developed what we call a moot in a box. That is sort of a set of instructions and checklists. Like, here's all you need to do in order to help make a moot happen in your region. So we'll give you your moot in a box, your instructions of all the things to do. And of course we'll help and support and talk you through all the things that we need to do. We'll help to build you a team of other volunteers, to help out. And it's really cool. So anyway, yeah. So it's going to be awesome. So what did I say? I said New England, I said Seattle, I said New York. We're working on New York as well. Bunches of things in the offing. We've been rumors about Ohio, maybe finally getting down to Australia. That'd be really fun. So we'll see. Anyway, lots of really great stuff. So good to see. I'm seeing a bunch of people who are going to be at one place or another. Morgan, going to see at LA Moot. Awesome. Good. And of course, Patricia, can't wait to see you and Susan at Bay Moot, of course, this weekend. Videography. Yeah, hey, Doc Tibbins, if you want to send me an email actually about that, I'd love to coordinate with you about that. That'd be awesome. Send me an email. Send an email to the info line. If you go to the Signum University website, just send the info at email that we have. That'll get to me too. So, send us a quick email. That'd be awesome. Dollar Stroke says Oxford Moot. Yeah, we're going to see about that. We're definitely planning. We did London Moot last year, of course, last April. And this coming spring, we definitely want to go back to Europe again. That was fun, and I want to do it again. So we're definitely working on that. I'm not quite sure the location yet. We're thinking about it. So, but that's definitely in the works. So anyway, okay. So that's the sort of fun stuff that's going on. The hope, of course, is that all of you will be able to find an event near you. I just love, over the years, it's one of the things that I've come to value a great deal. Of course, obviously, at Mythgard and Signum, we're really committed to using the internet as a tool to connect with people. And we've been so grateful for all of you guys, all the people we've been able to connect with over the years and the relationships that we've built. But there's nothing that really replaces being able to be in the same place and hang out and really connect in person too. And this sort of balance, right, of being able to do our regular internet stuff and to develop our online community, but to punctuate that with as frequent as possible opportunities to actually get together with people has been a really, really good combination. And I'm excited to see our regional MOOT program develop. Our sort of semi-experimental rollout of that last year with our three new regional MOOTs last year was a huge success, and I was so happy with that. And so this year we're looking at maybe 8 or 9 regional MOOTs this year. So good times this year. And as I said, I hope that all of you will be able to find something that's close enough to you that you can take a day trip or an overnight or something and get to one. But anyway, let us go on to some more uplifting stuff, namely the misadventures of poor Beline. One thing that I want to acknowledge before we move on any further, because it's going to be, I'm sure, in the minds of some of you, and so I just want to address it off the top. And if you didn't know this, then I wanted to make sure that you're thinking about it before we talk about the adventures of Sir Beline. So, as many of you know, the collection of dwarves that Bilbo travels to the Lonely Mountain with, their names are almost entirely drawn from the Voluspa. There's the list of dwarves in the Voluspa, and almost all of them are taken from that list directly. Almost all, right? There is one exception, and it's weird, right? It's weird that everybody, including Gandalf, of course, because Gandalf was originally the name of Thorin, right? Originally the name of one of the dwarves. So it seems strange. It seems conspicuous that Tolkien would derive all of the names of the dwarves except one from the Voluspa. And the one name of all of the dwarves of Thorin's companions that is not from the Voluspa is Balin. Balin the Lookout Man, right? Of course, and we all know, Balin's sort of later career and the kind of prominence, not only within the course of The Hobbit as, one of the sort of coolest and friendliest of the dwarves and closest to Bilbo, the one who comes to visit him, right, at the end and everything. But obviously, his future career and in the end, tragical death. But when casting around for some kind of explanation, Balin has stumped Tolkien scholars pretty much forever, right? Nobody understands why Balin the dwarf, alone of all of the dwarves, does not have a name from the Voluspa. And so trying to find something. And yes, Arthur, Dwalin is not only from the Voluspa, he's a really prominent, Dwalin was a famous dwarf, right? Dwalin is one of the highest profile names of all of the dwarf names. And then there's Balin, which is not from the Voluspa, even though, he's his brother and their names rhyme. As I said, Balin has been a stumper for a long time. And so one of the things that, of course, a lot of people have done have been like, is this some other illusion, right? And the only literary figure whose name has been connected, that people kind of wildly speculate, could it possibly be this? Because in fact, Balin seems like a fairly common name, right? It seems like a really simple name, but actually there are not very many Balins in literature. There's just not too many. But this one is here, of course. And there are people, you can read it in John Ratliff's History of the Hobbit when he's talking about the dwarf names. He's like, the only possible antecedent that seems even plausible is Sir Balin in, Sir Mallory's Mordor Thur. I don't buy it. So it's hard, because on the one hand, I don't buy it. The character of Balin, Balin the dwarf, seems to be nothing like the character of the Knight of the Two Swords. So I've always been super resistant to any kind of connection there. However, However, you know, he is, it's when you do read Balin's story, especially knowing Túrin Túrinbar, right, and how much Tolkien not only wrote the Túrin story, but loved the Túrin story and wrote and rewrote the Túrin story. I mean, there is something very Túrin-esque, right, about Sir Balin. So, you know, I can certainly see Tolkien really liking this story. But I cannot see any connection between Balin the Dwarf and Sir Balin. And I agree with several of you, with Morgan and with Carita. Honestly, my number one theory has always been that it's he just it rhymes, right? He invented a rhyme for Dwalin. I mean, I think it might be as simple as that. I often think that sometimes Tolkien scholars get kind of caught on wanting to find antecedents to everything, right? When they're sometimes Tolkien just makes stuff up, right? And I think that the similarity between Balin the Dwarf's name and Sir Balin in Mallory can very likely be pure coincidence. Brian, we do know that Tolkien read Mallory. I mean, he wasn't as interested in it as, say, C.S. Lewis was, right, who wrote on Mallory several times and talked about it a great deal, about the importance of Sir Thomas Mallory in his, like, youth, right, when he first read Mallory, and, you know, his letters talking about his experiences reading Mallory and stuff. So, you know, we know that Mallory was a huge deal for C.S. Lewis. Less big of a deal for Tolkien, but he definitely knew it. Definitely. Anyway, so yeah, Duller Stroke says, make a shout out for Inklings and Arthur. Yeah, the role of the King Arthur stuff in Tolkien, I think, is often underrated, but I think it's definitely there. Definitely there. But anyway, just I just wanted to kind of, I didn't want the Balin thing, and I knew it might have been in some of your minds, and so I didn't want to kind of leave that as like the sort of elephant in the room. Okay, so yes, and Dora Stroke, you're absolutely right. Anybody who has not yet gotten the Inklings and King Arthur book, edited by Serena Higgins, is totally missing out on awesome stuff about the Arthurian world and Lewis and Tolkien and Williams, and really, 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 really awesome stuff. You know, that book that just won the Mythopoeia Award, you know, come on. It's awesome. Okay. With that addressed, then, let us move on. Got a lot to talk about tonight. So the thing I want to do first, naturally, is not start on the tale of Sir Balin. There's one thing from the last section that I didn't get to, but actually I was delighted to save it for tonight because I actually think it's very, very relevant to tonight's discussion. And that's this moment when we're told about Merlin's role in writing down the stories, right? Or in having the stories written down. Than Merlin took his leave of King Arthur and of the twa kingas for to go, that is, Bors and Ban, remember, those are the twa kingas in question who are with King Arthur that Merlin has taken his leave of, for to go see his master Blois that dwelled in Northumberland. And so he departed, it's Merlin's master, right? And so he departed and come to his master that was passing glad of his coming. And there he told how Arthur and the twa kingas had sped at the great battle, and how it was ended, and told the names of every king and knecht of worship that was there. And so Blois wrote the battle word by word, as Merlin told him, how it began, and by whom, and in likewise how it was ended, and who had the worst. And all the battles that were done in Arthur's days, Merlin did his maester Blois read them. Also, he did read all the battles that every worthy knecht did of Arthur's court. Okay, so Merlin, in addition to all of his other activities, Merlin's a busy guy, right? Merlin's got to be, Merlin's got to be, you know, he's got to be like going around delivering spoilers. He's got to be disguising himself as one person or another, right? Anyway, he's a busy guy. But one of the things, one of his responsibilities, right, is not himself to write things, right? Blois, his master, right, the teacher of Merwin, is the actual recorder. But Merwin, but he apparently stays in Northumberland, right? Blois is like in semi-retirement in Northumberland, while Merwin is scampering about the country doing this and that, and then coming and reporting to Blois about everything that happened so that it can be written down, right? He did his master, Blois, write all of these things. Now, Carita says, is it weird for to anyone else to think about Merlin having a master? It is a little bit strange, right? I mean, it's one of the interesting touches about Merlin. There are going to be a couple of these, right? But it's one of the interesting touches that kind of humanizes Merlin. Merlin, he's come out of nowhere, right? He keeps coming out of nowhere. He's this enchanter dude. We have no idea exactly how his magic works. Sometimes he's acting as if he were like an Old Testament prophet. Sometimes he's just sort of foretelling the future like he's read ahead in the book, right? He's disguising himself, that kind of enchantment. He can put King Pellinor to sleep, right? We can see other things like that that he can do. He always seems to know everything about everybody. But also, apparently, he's a guy, right? Like, he had a teacher. He's a person who had a youth, apparently. Used to be somebody's apprentice. And the person whose apprentice he used to be is still around, right? Living in semi-retirement, writing down the stuff. It is kind of interesting. But what we see, right, is the connection between Merlin and the narrator of the story, right? This note here really kind of solidifies that, because you'll notice what he's actually writing, right? That is, look at the description. What Mallory emphasizes that Merlin pays special attention to in order for his master Blois to write down, right? The battle, how it began and by whom, and in likewise how it was ended and who had the worst, which sounds just like exactly the description we just got, right, of the battle. And all the battles that were done in Arthur's dies, and all the battles that every worthy knight did of Arthur's court. So the battle that just happened, right? We start with that, and then he's like, no, and all the battles, right? All the important battles he wrote down. And we're going to get many of the important battles, right? And also we're going to follow the career of particular knights, right? Of particular worthy knights. So when a particular worthy knight does, noteworthy battles as well, right? We're going to record those as well. This is exactly what we're getting from Sir Thomas Malory, right? So there's an interesting sort of gesture. I won't be stronger about it than that, but Mallory is here making a gesture at giving a fictional explanation for how his book got written, right? On the one hand, he's kind of open about who he is and that he's writing it, right? He's going to write his sign-offs, right? And talk about himself a little bit, you know, like that he's a knight and a prisoner. He's writing this book from prison, keep himself busy. All that. And by the way, prison, of course, means like house arrest. Like he was captured in battle and is being held for ransom or something, is what it means when he says he's a knight prisoner. But here's Mallory ascribing essentially his work. Again, not explicitly. He hasn't totally identified the work that we're reading with Merlin's work, right? But it's extremely suggestive. And at the very least, I think that seems to be a kind of an implication that at the very least, some of the sources that Mallory is working with go back to Merlin, right? So two things, two kind of takeaways that I would give here. One is this gesture towards authenticity, right? These things that you're hearing about, these things are known, right? They're known because Merlin had them written down, right? We're getting eyewitness accounts in a sense anyway. I say in a sense, because a lot of the events of the story Merwin is going to be around for. Now, that doesn't seem to stop him knowing all about them. He talks like an eyewitness, even if he's not been an eyewitness, right? But nevertheless, and we'll see a lot of that here later on tonight. But so that's one thing. Xenia says maybe Blois is the author of the French book that Mallory's often talking about. Yeah, well, Mallory has a couple sources, right? The French book is an important one. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But anyhow, yeah, Zach, it is kind of Blois' fault that we have two different stories about Excalibur. Yeah. So again, that gesture towards creating a mythic story that gives authenticity to the narrative is just an interesting gesture to see Mallory making, right? However, the other thing, the other take home for me from this passage is this similarity, right? This connection, this kind of conjunction between Merlin's activities and the activities of the narrator, Merlin as storyteller. And so thinking about Merlin as storyteller, Merlin as chronicler and narrator of these stories, or at least the one who is seeing them narrated and chronicled, really kind of puts things in an interesting context when we come to Merlin's activities throughout the tale of Sir Balin. Oh, Arthur, that's awful. Concerning the story of the two Excaliburs, Arthur adds that Blois will be Blois. Oh dear. Anyway, yeah. Okay, I like that one, Arthur. Keep that connection between Merlin and the narrator in mind as we go through here tonight. Okay, so the story of Sir Balin begins. He is not a prisoner. He's been released. He was a prisoner in Arthur's court, right? Because he killed a guy, one of Arthur's kinsmen, in clean battle, but Arthur was, upset about it. So Arthur took him captive, but some of his barons vouched for Sir Balin, so he was set free. But he is of little account at Arthur's court, right? He is very low on the ladder in the rankings. Balin is way down at the bottom, and he's poor, which, as we'll see, has a lot to do with it too. So the king comes to Camelot. So Juan the king was come thither with all his baronage, and lodged as they seemed best. There was come a damoiselle, the which was sent from the great Lady Lille of Avilion. And when she come before King Arthur, she told fro whence she come, and how she was sent on message unto him for this causes. Then she let her mantle fall that was richly furred, and then she was girded with a noble sword, whereof the king had marvile, and sighed, "Damosel, for what cause are ye girt with that sword? It beseemeth you nought." "Now shall I tell you," said the damosel. "This sword that I am girt withal doth me great sorrow and cumbrance, for I may not be delivered of this sword but by a knecht, and he must be a passing good man of his hondes and of his dades, and without villainy, other treachery, and without treason. And if I may find such a knecht that hath all these virtues, he may draw out this sword out of the sheath, for I have been at King Royan's. For it was told me there were passing good knechtes, and he and all his knechtes hath a side, and none can speed." All right. So, what is this story? Right. It starts like a sort of a standard marvel. This is a thing that we will see lots of times over the course of the book. This is something that we have had lots of opportunity to see lots of times throughout medieval Arthurian story. Arthur is at a place, often Camelot, but not always, and he's having some kind of feast, right? That they've arrived, often it's on a special occasion, not always, as in this case, that is like on a holiday or something. And somebody shows up with some marvel, right? And here in this case, it's this damsel with the sword, right? And she is greatly sorrowed and encumbered by this sword, and it cannot be drawn except by a knight, right? And so she, the marvel here, notice, invites the knights not only to prove themselves, which is a good thing in itself, right? But also to deliver her, right? So here's a damsel who needs to be delivered of some enchantment or some curse. She is doomed to wear this sword until it can be taken out of the scabbard. And that seems, like a noble thing to do, right? To help this poor damsel. So this is great. Like, we get to do a disenchantment and save the damsel and prove yourself, as, you know, the greatest knight, or kind of the greatest knight. And it doesn't exactly say, like, only the greatest knight in the world. We'll get a bunch of those later on. Like, only the greatest knight in the world can do this. Those aren't the terms exactly, right? But, anyway, so Joe, Avilion, this is Avalon, right? Lady Lyle of Avalon is the Lady of the Lake. Presumably the same Lady of the Lake that we met, who came walking across the water like no big deal. She was just strolling across the water from that, like, elf mound, right? Within which Merlin said was a palace and everything, right? So we've got this sort of fairy other world, and the Lady of the Lake comes strolling out across the lake, and she's like, hey, you want that sword? Let's do a deal, right? And she makes Arthur promise her to give him whatever she asks in exchange, right? Later on, she'll come with a request. You know, someday, and that day will certainly come, I will come to you and make a request, and you will give it to me. Anyway, yeah, so there we go. So Lady of the Lake sent her, this damsel, right? So that's good, right? Because the Lady of the Lake is good. She's a good fairy. Gave him the sword, gave the king the sword, right? So that's all good. So this seems fine. And notice the terms of the test, right? The terms of the test are not, again, it's not just to be the greatest knight in the world. You do have to be a passing good man of his hondas and of his deedas. Right? Two different things, right? To be a good man of your hands means to be strong, effective in battle, right? I mean, if you are a good man of his hondas, that means you can kick butt in battle. And of his deedas. Now, of his deedas is a little bit more, to be a good man of your deeds means not only that you've accomplished a lot of stuff, again, proven yourself, but also that you've done good deeds, right? That you do good things. So there's an implication of virtue here. And then that's made explicit in the second half, right? That, you not only have to be a passing good man of your hands and your deeds, but you also have to be without villainy or treachery or treason. And these three things are kind of, they're closely related, right? They're not exactly synonymous, but they're pretty close. Villainy, treachery, or treason, right? You need to be honest, straightforward, keeping your word, not bent on any low things or seeking any low ends or doing dishonorable deeds. This is about virtue. Right? More than it is about accomplishment. Exactly. An accomplishment is involved, or at least potential for accomplishment is involved, but it's not the whole deal, right? So again, this looks like, that makes it look like an even easier win, right? Again, you're going to save the damsel from her enchantment. You're going to prove yourself with all the court, and only one who is virtuous, not just powerful, but virtuous, can get there. So this is great, right? This sounds like just a wonderful kind of situation. Oh, and there's another little kind of tantalizing temptation there for Arthur at the end, right? I just came from the court of your rival, you know, King Royans, who's the one, he's the one, you may remember, at the end of the last section of reading, he's the one who wrote to King Arthur demanding his beard for his cloak, right? I'm making a cloak out of the beards of kings. Could you send me yours, right? Or I'll come get it. So that's that guy, right? Who is the number one enemy of King Arthur. So yeah, I was at his court because I heard there were awesome knights at King Royan's court, but none of them could do it, right? So I wonder if anybody here at your court is able to do it, right? So you've got this this competition with King Royan's, which makes it particularly attractive. Yeah. So this sounds great, right? What could go wrong? Now, I just realized let me answer a quick Lang question. Yeah, so Zach asks a great question. Does treason mean what it means nowadays, or does it have some other meaning? It doesn't have a different meaning. Treason is used a little bit more broadly. I mean, it's not, you know, treason means is specifically a sort of a like a political thing. Like if you are betraying your country, you're committing treason, right? It didn't mean that exactly, or at least, I mean, it does mean if you did that, they would have said you had committed treason. But you can be accused of treason for betray, but it's the same concept, right? To betray an oath, to betray, somebody who trusted you, somebody to whom you owe loyalty, without it having to be like a national kind of thing. Morgan asks, is Lady Lyle her given name? Seems to be. She wasn't named before. She's just called the Lady of the Lake, right? But this seems to be presumably that same lady. Carita says that the no villainy, treachery, or treason sounds like insurance against sneaky loopholes. Yeah, possibly. I mean, that kind of repetition, at the very least, or semi-repetition again, at the very least seems to emphasize Carita, right? Like, no, like, we mean it, right? Like, seriously, nothing of that kind. So what comes of this? That's fine. So then Sir Balin comes up to her, right? So she's leaving. Arthur can't pull it out, right? Nobody in the court can draw her sword, right? So she's leaving in disappointment. And then Balin comes up to her and says, "Damosel, I pray you of your courtesy, suffer me as well to assay as these other lordes. Though that I be poorly arrayed, yet in my heart meseemeth I am fully assured as some of these other. And meseemeth in mine heart to speed right well." This damosel then beheld this poor knicht, and saw he was a leakly man. But for his poor arrayment, she thought he should not be of no worship without villainy or treachery. And then she said unto that knicht, "Sir, it needeth not you to put me to no more pine, for it seemeth not you to spade, thereas all these other knichtes have filed." "Ah, fair damosel," said Balin, "worthiness and good touches and also good deeds is not only an arrayment, but manhood and worship is hid within a man's person, and many a worshipful knicht is not knowen unto all people, and therefore worship and hardiness is not an arrayment." "Be God," said the damsel, "ye say soth. Therefore ye shall assay to do what ye may." Then Balin took the sword by the girdle and sheath and drew it out easily, and when he looked on the sword, it pleased him much. Then had the king and all the baroners great marvel that Balin had done that adventure. Many knichtes had great despite at him. Okay, don't judge by the outward appearance, right? Although I am poorly arrayed, right? I'm dressed in poor. I know I don't look good. Right. I look poor. I look like I'm nobody. Right. But I am as assured in my heart to speed well. Right. To be fortunate in my attempt. I'm as confident as any of the rest of them are. And I think that his talking about his heart there, in my heart meseemeth I am fully assured as some of these other, right? It seems to me, meseemeth means it seemeth to me, right? In my heart, it seems to me that I am as fully assured as some of these others. So he's saying, he seems to be saying only, I am as confident as they were, right? I have as much belief in myself as those other guys who also tried. But then he says, and meseemeth in mine heart to speed right well. And there I think he's saying a little bit more. And it seems in my heart to speed right well. I think this is Balin saying, I believe in myself as much as they do, and I you should give me a chance as much as you gave them a chance. But I think in the end he's also saying, and I think in my heart I think I'm going to do this, right? He has some, I think he's pointing to some kind of sense, some kind of premonition or something that he has in his heart that he's going to speed. Right. That this is, in fact, this quest was meant for him. Right. This aventure is designed for him. Sarah, what does despite mean here? Many Kanitas had great despite at him. They resent it. Right. They feel resentful towards him. They feel like they've been shown up by this loser. Right. This nobody. They are not happy with that. So yes, James Stevens, exactly. We get here the not all that is gold glitters thing here, right? That is part of Balin's thing. Yeah, I couldn't help but think of the story of the anointing of King David as well. You know, man judges by the outward appearance, but God sees the heart. This is a fairly common theme, right? So there's nothing strange, right, about this idea. And so when he points out this truism, right, she's like, you say sooth, right? No, you're right. You got me. You're right. I shouldn't judge you by your clothes. You can try, right? Nancy asks, about what does being likely mean? Saw that he was a likely man. Does it mean that he's handsome? And if so, then that's judging him by the outward appearance again, right? In a different way. Likely is a little bit more than just handsome. It doesn't mean that she likes him. It means that he looks likely, right? So, like, from a distance, when she's just looking at him in a crowd with the rest of the lords, he's shabby, right? So shabbiness is what you see from a distance. When you come up closer to Sir Balin, you can see that, yeah, his clothes are shabby, but underneath, this guy's pretty well put together, right? And it's not just about, like, I think this guy is hot. It's about, this guy looks like, you know, he would, might be a pretty good man of his Hondas, right? You know, this is, He looks fit. He looks powerful. He looks like a guy who could really take care of himself on the battlefield, right? So even if he hasn't proven himself yet, likely is a word like that that's often used of somebody who has not yet proven himself in battle. But when you look at him, people look at him and are like, oh, this guy has potential, right? In other words, you know, so like, a really good high school pitcher might be considered likely by a professional scout, right? Who's scouting before the baseball draft or something like that. That's what likely means in this context. Okay. What was the other thing I was going to emphasize here? One last quick note, because this is a super important piece of vocabulary in Mallory as a whole, worship and worshipful. We're going to hear a lot of people talking about worship. And on the one hand, worship means fame, right? How much other people respect you, your reputation. So when you talk about gaining much worship, that means lots of people saying really good things about you, right? Your reputation increasing. So often the word worship really just means fame like that. But to think of it that way, to think of worship as just being what everyone is saying about you, it doesn't quite get it. There is an objective concept, right, of worshipfulness. Look at what he's saying. Many a worshipful knicht is not knowen unto all people, right? you can be worshipful without having any fame at all, right? You can't be famous if nobody knows you, right? You can be likely, but you can't. It would be totally inappropriate to say, nobody knows him yet. He's famous, but nobody knows him yet, right? I mean, that's just a contradiction if we say that. So worshipful is not a synonym of famous. Balin says there's many a worshipful knight who is not known to anybody yet, who has no reputation yet. So worship and worshipfulness is about more than just what people say about you. And this has two consequences, right? One is that it's a description of like internal worthiness as much as it is. It's not just about what people say. It's not about gossip. It's not about playing to the crowd or being, it's not a popularity contest thing. It's about deservingness. There are many knights who are deserving of credit, deserving of reputation, deserving of honor and respect, even if they haven't won it yet, right? Even if no one has given it to them yet, nevertheless, they still are worshipful themselves, right? Worship and hardiness is not an arraignment, right? It's not an external thing. The other consequence of this, of course, is it means that worship is not, it's not fickle, right? Fame is fickle. Fame ebbs and flows, right? You can be famous one day and everyone can forget about you the next day. But if you're worshipful, you'll be just as worshipful the next day, even if no one else is still talking about you, right? So there's a correlation between fame and worship, but they're not identical. Mike, I think honor is probably the best way to think about it. He uses that word too, so I don't want to just blur them together, but exactly as Dolores says, can I call you Dolly? says it the word worth is in there, the word worship. It's worthiness, essentially. But again, that's going to be a super important word. So keep an eye on that one. All right. Let's keep going. Because he's got this shiny magic sword now, right, that he pulled out of the sheath. Certes, sighed the damosel, this is a passing good knecht, and the best that ever I found, and most of worship without treason, treachery, or felony. And many marvels shall he do. Now, gentle and courteous knecht, give me the sword again. Nay, said Balin, for this sword will I keep, but it be taken from me by force. Well, said the damosel, ye are not wise to keep the sword from me, for ye shall slay with that sword the best friend that ye have, and the man that ye most love in the world, and that sword shall be your destruction. Okay, it's not just me hearing Turin Turambar echoes in the background, right? I shall tak the aventure, said Balin, that God will ordain for me, but the sword ye shall not have at this time, by the faith of my body. Ye shall repent it within short time, said the damosel, for I will have the sword more for your advantage than for mine, for I am passing heavy for your sack. For an ye will not leave that sword, it shall be your destruction, and that is great pity. So he makes a stubborn decision, right? This is Balin acting rashly, right? He will keep this sword. He's warned against it. If you keep that sword, you're going to slay your best friend and it will be your destruction. But he says, that's fine. I'm not going to give it back still, right? I insist I'm going to keep it. Tara, passing heavy. Heavy means sad, sorrowful, right? So to be passing, I am passing heavy for your sake. I am very sad. I'm very sorry for you, right? It makes me sad to think about you, surpassingly so, right? And no, other Terra, there is no different. There is no two Terras in each chat room here, or one in each chat room. There is no difference between I versus the Y versus I for the first person pronoun. Yeah. I's and Y's as vowels are interchangeable. Pretty much. There's really no difference, that I know of. Jennifer says he's not traitorous, villainous, or treasonous, but he's also possibly not too bright. Yeah, or at least stubborn, right? Karita says she feels like he passed the first test and failed the second one. Yeah, possibly. Yana asks, are we supposed to see this as the point of no return? Is his fate now decided? Well, she says so, right? I mean, if she's to be believed, then yeah, if he keeps the sword, he's going to kill the man he most loves in the world, and it's going to be his destruction, right? It's done. The thing that I mostly want to emphasize is his response. Because this is... In my reading, this is the theme of the entire story of Sir Balin. I shall tak the aventure that God will ordain for me. I shall tak the aventure that God will ordain. Ordain is an important word. This is not, I'm going to take whatever might happen to come, that God will ordain. God has his plan. It's going to work out, and I'm going to take it. I'm not going to try to escape it. But, you know, there might be some people, right? Like, I don't know. There might be some king somewhere who hear a rumor. Well, okay, not a rumor. Who are told flatly by Merlin that there's like a kid out there, his own son who's going to unseat him and stuff. And so what? So you might, if you're that king, decide that you're going to kill all the kids, right? So as to try to prevent this prophecy from coming true. Not Sir Balin, man. That's not, he doesn't play like that. He's not going to try to avoid anything. He says, hey, whatever God ordains, bring it. Bring it. I shall take the aventure. I shall take the chance that God will ordain. Right? So you've got aventure on the one hand, which suggests a chance happening. Right? Something that's going to come along. But it's not chance. It's not really just an aventure. God's ordaining it, right? And whatever God ordains, Sir Balin says, okay, let's do this. Now, Karita asks very sensibly, is he blaming God for his bad choices? Well, I don't think that that's what he's meaning when he says that. I don't think he's saying, oh, God made me do it, right? I don't think it's that. I think he's saying, on the one hand, he's not backing down from his choice. He made the choice, I want to keep this sword, right? This sword rules, I'm keeping it. And I think it's not just a, like, this sword is a more upgrade, right? Like, you know, this sword is a +3 sword and my old sword is only a +1 sword, so I'm totally keeping this magic sword. It's not just that, right? He was obscure. He was nobody. He was looked down on by everybody in King Arthur's court, especially by Arthur, who was holding him a prisoner before he got out grudgingly on bail, right? So now this sword is the symbol of his worship, right? Of this, you know, he was a worshipful Knecht, whether anybody knew it or not, right? Now everybody knows it, and this sword has been the key to that. And he doesn't want to let that go. Right, he feels that it belongs to him, right? But having made that decision, he's not going to back down from it just because something bad is threatened, right? Is something bad going to happen? Well, I will take the aventure that God will ordain. And so, Karita, I read that as from here out, right? I'm willing to abide by what happens. Is this a statement of faith? Yes, in a sense, it's a statement of faith. But keep in mind, I don't think this is a statement of faith, like that God is going to ordain a good result for him. I don't think that he's saying, well, I'm going to go ahead because I don't think that God is really going to make that happen. Right. I don't think God is going to let me like kill the man I love best in the world and sort of be my destruction. Like God's going to protect me. So I'm just going to go forward trusting that God will ordain a good plan for me. That I do not think that is what Sir Balin means here at all. I think he's saying, let happen what happens. Right. I've chosen this. You're saying that it's going to lead to this terrible thing. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But whether it does or not, I will take the aventure that God ordains. So yeah, come what may, this is my sword now, Boomful says. Yeah. This will be, we'll see more of this, right? This is the first, but not the only time we are going to hear this sentiment. Watch where and how it gets repeated and applied as we move through the story. Okay. Oh, and of course the breath, it will not love the hand it serves. That's shameless. Those are, of course, the words of Melian to Beleg about Anglachel, the sword. Cause I just like could not get Beleg out of my head in this passage. But I promise I'll stop making Turin references. Oh, okay, that's a rash vow. I take it back. Anyway, okay, let's keep going. So Balin has taken his sword. The damsel is still there, but she's been delivered. Everything seems happy, right? But he's leaving. Balin is leaving. And then the Lady of the Lake shows up. And this is the same Lady of the Lake who gave Arthur the sword. We know because she's now coming to claim she's now coming to claim his promise, right? He promised that he would give her a boon, in exchange for the sword. And so she comes to collect. And I love his first question. Arthur's like, hey, I forgot. What does Excalibur mean again? Like, I know its name is Excalibur, but what does it mean? I know it has a meaning. What does it mean? And she's like, oh, its name is Excalibur. No, actually, no, he forgets the name. He's like, what's the sword called again? It's called Excalibur, she says, and it means cut steel. Okay, right. Fine. So great. So he says, ye say well, said the king. Ask what ye will, and ye shall have it, and it lie in my power to give it. Now, that's a bad sign, right? Anytime, it's like, just like, you know, in Tolkien, in the Silmarillion, whenever anybody takes a really solemn oath, you start to get a little twitchy, like it's probably going to go poorly for them, right? Whenever someone, especially King Arthur, says, ask what ye will and ye shall have it, and it lie in my power to give it, it's not going to be good, right? Don't make the rash promises. Okay. Well, sighed this laddie, then I ask the head of this knecht that hath won the sword, other else the damsel's head that brought it. I talk no force, though I have both their heads, for he slew my brother, a good knecht and a true, and that gentlewoman was causer of my father's death. Truly, said King Arthur, I may not grant you neither of their heads with my worship. Therefore, ask what ye will else, and I shall fulfill your desire. I will ask none other thing, said the laddie. Okay, so this is awkward. This is very awkward, right? She wants Sir Balin's head, or the head of the damsel who came girt with the sword, or both. And I love her turn of phrase. I talk no force. To talk no force of something means like you don't care one way or the other, right? I talk no force, which we just mean I don't care which one, right? So I talk no force, though I have both their heads. Like I wouldn't mind, you know. So she's saying it very kind of backhandedly, like, hey, I wouldn't say no to both their heads. In fact, right? It's fine, one or the other, or you know, if you're feeling generous, both. That'd be fine too. Okay, so. This is very awkward. Now, a couple things that we see here. Number one, we see, of course, Arthur caught in conflicting duties, right? He says, I may not grant you neither of their heads with my worship, right? If I give you... So poor Arthur is caught in a cleft stick, right? If he says no to her, he has broken his word and his promise to give her what she asks in exchange for his sword, right? And if he gives her what she's asking, then he is guilty. I mean, he has brought in the damsel and accepted her. You know, she's come into his court, right? And Sir Balin is not only also now in his court, but is... has just distinguished himself, right? And so this is super, super awkward. Zachary says, is this the same Lady of the Lake who sent the damsel in the first place? Yes. Yes, I believe this is the same Lady of the Lake that sent the damsel in the first place. Yeah, several of you are remembering John the Baptist. Rash vows, right? Herod had to give up the head of John the Baptist because of a similar rash vow. Yes, we do have every reason to believe that this Lady of the Lake who has come, who is the Lady of the Lake, Arthur's Lady of the Lake, the one who walked across the water to him, is the one who sent the damsel, and she's now asking for that damsel's head, right? The damsel came and said that she came with a message from the Lady of the Lake, right? And now that Lady of the Lake comes and says, well, I guess the message was like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern message in the end, right? She's come and say, I want that damsel's head, or Sir Balin's head, or both. Now, another thing that we notice here, the premises, right? Why does she want the heads of Sir Balin and the damsel? Remember when we were introduced to her earlier in the giving of Excalibur situation to start with, right? She was a very otherworldly figure, right? Walking across the water, living in an elf mound on an island, right? Oh, over there, that's Avalon, that, like, I don't know what, apparently fairly small isle. And there's a palace in there, right? It's a magical place. And she comes walking out across the water. Now we hear, so is she a fairy? Is she an otherworldly queen? Is that who the Lady of the Lake is? Well, apparently not, because the reason that she gives for why she wants these two people dead, is that Sir Balin she wants dead because he slew her brother, who was a knight, right? And the damsel was the causer of her father's death. And I don't think these are her fairy brother and her fairy father. The Lady of the Lake sounds like she sounds human. She's got human connections who are interacting with other human connections. I don't know what this means. That is, let me say a very simple thing and kind of leave it at that, because I can't explain this. The status of the fairy world in Mallory is super interesting and complicated, right? The boundary between fairy and the mortal world is really weird. Now, the boundary of fairy is always really weird, right? That's part of the nature of the boundary of fairy, but not weird in that sense, right? Not weird in the sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not sense, or, you know, like you can't cross it without being, you know, whatever. It's not weird in that sense. There's these crossovers. Merlin, of course, is a walking example of the weirdness, right? Where sometimes he is like straight out of fairy and sometimes he's not. Working within a totally different tradition. Morgan is asking if Lady Lyle, as she was called before, is derived from Lille, like the island in French. That seems to me extremely likely that she'd be called the Lady Lyle because she's the Lady of the Island. Lady Lyle of Avalon, like the Lady of the Isle of Avalon. Yeah, I that seems to me super plausible, right? So what's up with ferries here? And what's up with the kind of traffic back and forth? Do we have ferries who involve themselves in human relations, right? Do we have, like, did somebody's father take a fairy wife, right? Like one of the Took ancestors putatively did? Or is it the other way around? Do we have humans who can, like, enter into the fairy world? Honestly, that's my vote, right? And Morgan Le Fay is the primary example of this. Morgan Le Fay is human. We know who her parents are, right? And yet she is called Le Fay, right? And she is heavily involved with the lake business. Lady Lyle of the Lake, this Lady of the Lake who is appearing before King Arthur with his super awkward request, seems to have human parents and a human family. How did she get to be Lady of the Lake? What the heck does that even mean? No clue. And we're never going to know. Mallory's never going to explain. It's really unknown. So I can't explain all the mysteries here. I just want to point out that this situation is really weird and super interesting, and encourage you, if you are interested, to pursue it further. There's lots of really interesting comparisons that you can do. A really detailed study of Maori's treatment of fairies and fairy elements is a super interesting study, I think. We don't have time to focus on that exclusively here, but just wanted to kind of throw that out there. Exactly, Karita. You can take it as an encouragement, right? Karita says, take heart, my fellow human ladies. We too can attain magical lake lady status. See, exactly. You can get a promotion, move to Avalon. Maybe you can get a promotion, move to Avalon, become the Lady of the Lake, and also get a degree in nigromancy. Who knows, right? Apparently, that's also a career path that's available to you. Anyway, so... Ryan, I agree. The story seemed to more to focus on human interactions and politics in the oaths and motivations of Balin. Therefore, it seems to better suit the story for the lady to be a human with human relations to kill, whereas in the Excalibur story, the status of both the sword and the lady as magical and otherworldly were more important. I agree. And no, Tara, we have no plans at the current time for Signum to be offering a degree in nigromancy. No, we're just not going to do that, which I suppose means that our program is less competitive than that particular nunnery school where you can get so learned that you become a master of nigromancy. We were not going to offer the masters in nigromancy, in fact. Okay. So just when you thought this situation couldn't get any more awkward, Arthur is saved in the most awkward manner possible. So Juan Balian was ready to depart. He saw the Lady of the Lock, which by her meanness had slain his motor, and he had sucked this 3 year before. And when it was told him how she had asked his head of King Arthur, he went to her straight and said, "Evil be ye found, ye would have mine head, and therefore ye shall lose yours." And with his sword, leekly he smote off her head before King Arthur. "Alas, for sham," said the king. "Why have ye do so? Ye have shammed me and all me court, for this laddie was a laddie that I was much beholding to, and hither she come under my self-conduct. Therefore I shall never forgive you that trespass."
"Sir," said Balin, "me forthinketh of your displeasure, for this Sam laddie was the untruest laddie living, and by enchantment and by sorcery she hath been the destroyer of many good Kinectus, and she was causer that my motor was brent through her falsehood and treachery."
"For whatsoever, what cause soever ye had," said Arthur, "ye should have forborne in my presence. Therefore think not the contrary. Ye shall repent it, for such another despite had I never in my court. Therefore, withdraw you out of my court in all the haste that ye may.
Whew, okay. So I when I first read Sir Thomas Malory, as I said, as I've mentioned before, there are a couple moments that really, especially words and phrases that just captured my imagination and which I rolled around on my tongue for weeks and months afterwards. I don't think there is a single moment in Sir Thomas Malory that I remember more vividly the first time I read than this moment. I don't think I have ever been so shocked by a thing that happened in a book than this moment. I was so behind the Lady of the Lake thing. I'm like, oh, the Lady of the Lake has come, right? And she who gave Arthur and I was surprised by her request for Balin's head, but I was totally with her, right? I'm like, oh, so that's Sir Balin. Turns out he's a bad guy after all, right? That's an interesting twist, right? Okay, but you know, here's the Lady of the Lake. I was completely, and then whap, he comes in. I'm like, that dude just decapitated the Lady of the Lake. The Lady of the Lake is dead. She's lying bleeding on the floor, and he takes her head with him. Right? Oh man! I'm like, oh. So I really don't think I have ever been. I remember sitting there with my jaw hanging loose, being like, "Did that just? Surely I must have misread that. That can't have just happened, right?" Yeah, it was really funny. Yeah. That was to me a highly unexpected turn. So Joe, Sir, me forthinketh of your displeasure. So it forthinketh me. It means how to paraphrase it exactly. I regret it. Like, I'm sorry about, if I had to paraphrase this, I would say, sir, I regret your displeasure, right? I'm sorry that you're displeased, right? But that's not entirely it, right? Because you notice he doesn't say, but. May for thinketh of your displeasure, but this amladi. That's not what he says, right? For this amladi. May for thinketh of your displeasure. I think he's saying here, think twice about it, right? I had worried about your displeasure, Mike, that perhaps in some sense. Clearly, he knows what he's doing is not going to be popular, right? He knows he's putting King Arthur in an extremely difficult position here, but he's doing it anyway, right? And why is he doing it anyway? Because this Samladi was the untruest Ladi living. Okay, so from Arthur's point of view, this is difficult because, and the thing that makes this most difficult for Arthur is that this would have been embarrassing under any circumstances, right? She comes under his safe conduct, right? She was here under his protection. And under his protection, peacefully in his court, one of his knights has drawn his sword and swapped off her head, right? Lightly. Several of you really, really like the adjective lightly, or adverb, rather. With his sword, lightly, he smote off her head. It was nothing. Okay. The thing that makes it super awkward, again, it would be awkward under any circumstance, any lady under his safe conduct who comes and to whom he's beholden, right? I mean, it's a super bad look, but it's worse in that he had just been handed a dilemma, right? She had said, fulfill your promise and do this thing that you... So he really wants to get out of this. And now he's out of it, right? He doesn't have to give anybody's head. So he gets a free sword now. He got Excalibur, and in exchange, he promised to give her anything that she asked, and she asked for something, and he totally didn't want to give her what she asked for. And now he doesn't have to, right? So Arthur has just gotten a get-out-of-jail-free card, so it looks four times as bad as it would have otherwise, right? The fact that a lady in his court was just murdered in front of him, right, is bad. The fact that he profited by the murder of that lady in his court is, Corita, absolutely a public relations nightmare. Absolutely. So you can see how why Arthur is so upset about this, but look at Balin's answer, right? She was the untruest lady living. She was treacherous and treasonous. Those words really resonate, don't they? In the consequent, that he has proven that he was not of treachery or treason by drawing out the sword. He has shown not only his worthiness, but his virtue, right? In drawing, in miraculously drawing out the sword. And yet, the lady of the lake, he's accusing her of exactly those things. The one who sent the damsel with the sword that only the virtuous dude could pull out. Okay, but she's the untruest lady living. She destroys knights by enchantment and sorcery, right? His defense is not just, I had a personal vendetta against her. That's part of it, right? He does have a personal vendetta against her. She killed his mother, right? Or made his mother to be killed. She was burnt at the stake. Balin's mom burnt at the stake by the Lady of the Lake's contrivance, he says. He made that she should be burnt. She made that that his mother should be burnt. That's bad. Right? Now, ladies can get burnt for things. That's like the form of execution. A capital punishment for ladies, we tend to see burning. Is they don't tend to decapitate lady. Like a lady doesn't go to the block. She tends to get burned at the stake. So he is accusing her essentially of having framed his mom for whatever she was executed for whatever she was burnt for. And he has already, so remember, she wanted his head because he had killed her brother, right? And now we see that from a different angle, right? Balin has been hunting them down, right? So yes, he killed her brother. I bet he's proud of killing her brother, right? And he's been trying to get to her because she's horrible, right? According to Balin. Which is probably true. Probably. I don't know. Yeah, Corita, he does. It's Corita says her untruestness aside, he kind of took on judge, jury, and executioner roles in one light swap, right? Yeah, and that is awkward for the king. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we have a big, crazy situation. Who can possibly help us understand what's going on? Oh, wait, we have Merlin. So Balin leaves and he's in trouble. He's in serious disgrace now. So we have a very vicissitudinous career of Sir Balin, right? Merlin comes in. He was not here for any of this, right? But of course, Merlin knows the whole story. Now shall I say you, said Merlin, this same damsel that here standeth. Now here he's talking about the damsel who was wearing the sword. Right, the damsel who came in, sent by the Lady of the Lake with the sword. Right, so we're going to get the backstory of how did this lady come to be girt with the magic sword that couldn't be taken off. Right, okay. This same damsel that here standeth, that broke the swear unto your court, I shall tell you the cause of her coming. She is the falsest damsel that liveth. Oh man, not another one. She shall not say nay, for she hath a brother.
a passing god knecht of prowess, and a full true man, and this damosel loved another knecht that held her as paramour. And this god knecht, her brother, met with the knecht that held her to paramour, and slew him by force of his hondas. So here's this damsel, right? She has her lover, and she has her brother, and her brother and her lover fight, and her brother kills her lover, right? So here she's upset about this, as one might be. And when this false damsel understood this, she went to the laddie Leal of Avilion and besought her of help to be revenged on her own brother. So she goes to the Lady of the Lake to ask help to avenge herself on her own brother for killing her boyfriend, right? For killing her lover. Okay. All right, following Merlin. And so this laddie, Lyle of Avilion, that is the dead one, the decapitated one, took her this sword. So she brings the magic sword to her that she brought with her. That is, you know, so the one she was wearing, the Lady Lyle of Avilion gave her the sword and told there should no man pull it out of the sheath, but if he be one of the best knechtes of this realm, and he shall be hardy and full of prowess, and with that sword he should slay his brother. This was the cows, damsel, that ye come here, but ye come never in fellowship of worshipful folk for to do good, but always great harm. And that knecht that hath enchaved the sword shall be destroyed through the sword, for the which will be great damage, for there liveth not a knecht of more prowess than he is, and he shall do unto you, my lord Arthur, great honour and kindness, and it is great pity that he shall endure but a while, for of his strength and hardiness I knew him not living his match.
Okay, so lots of competition for the title of falsest lady. Yeah, it turns out both of the ladies are no good, I guess. Right? Now, notice Merlin doesn't have anything to say about the trueness of the decapitated lady, right? He is remaining neutral on the question of whether Lady Lyle of Avilion deserted to have her head swapped off by Balin, right? But what he is saying is, oh, the damsel that we've been forgetting in all this time, right? Over the controversy surrounding the decapitation of the Lady of the Lake has distracted us from this other damsel. Who the heck is she? How did she get girt with that sword? And why did she come, right? And the answer is... Sorry, Stephen Cover was just suggesting maybe this damsel is the falsest lady now that the other lady is dead, right? She's now stepped into the role. She used to be the second falsest lady in the world. Now she's the falsest lady in the world. Stephen, I like that explanation. That's good. James is wondering, was the damsel's boyfriend the Lady of the Lake's brother? No, because Balin killed him, and Balin is not the damsel's brother. So, no, that can't be it. I have to admit, Joe says he needs a flowchart to determine who's getting revenge on whom. I know, it gets really complicated. And Joe, that's one of the first things that I want to take home here, right? Notice the vastly complicated, all that, like, let's not bicker and argue about who killed who, right? I mean, holy cow. So this whole situation, the sword, the vow from King Arthur, right? All of this stuff is entangled with this really complex, you killed this person and I'm trying to get revenge on you, and you, but you caused the death of my dad. Well, yeah, but you caused the death of my mom. These kinds of cycles of vengeance stuff that's going on. This is obviously an issue. This is a big problem. And the awkwardness of King Arthur, poor King Arthur, right? Now he does foolishly in administering the, you know, in administering, in delivering the rash vow, right? But other than that, he's kind of not done anything wrong here, right? He's sort of standing, trying to do the right thing in the middle of an extremely difficult situation. And here's everything just falling apart around him, right? Everybody turns out to have been scheming against everybody else and setting, and it turns out now that, like, Sir Balin has been hunting for 3 years for looking for the opportunity to decapitate the Lady of the Lake, who shows up at the same time. So it's all... this is a mess, right? So one thing that we can we can get from this is this kind of situation. This is a fairly prominent issue, right? The cycles of vengeance and the vendettas, which the multi-generational vendettas that continue on, this is going to cause a lot. This is not the last time that is going to cause a lot of problems, right? And it's going to become a major issue. In fact, it's going to be really at the heart of the story of the death of Arthur later on. So we get introduced to the fact of how messy all of this stuff gets, even before we try to sort out who is in fact treacherous and false and who isn't. Ooh, Karina, I agree. Faithful fellowship of worshipful folk would be a great kinship name in Lotro. I totally agree. Yes, that came never in fellowship of worshipful folk. That would be a really good kinship name. Anyway, yeah. Dolly says, this messy family killing back and forth reminds me of Njal's saga, where two families keep killing the other family's servants and just hand the same weregild in the same sack back and forth. Yeah, exactly. Now, I mean, this kind of... There's lots of precedent for this kind of thing, right? Anyway, okay, so... But I have to admit, there's something I just don't get at all here, right? I'm totally tracking with Merlin almost all the way through, but this really kind of... I don't understand the end of Merlin's story. Maybe some of you guys can help me, because I don't get it. Okay, so Merlin says... So the story is, I get the first paragraph, right? Damsel has a brother, has a boyfriend... Brother kills boyfriend. She makes the questionable, understandable. It's understandable that she's upset about her brother killing her paramour. But she then takes the radical step of setting out to murder her own brother in vengeance for her beloved, which is probably not a good choice. But anyway, there it is. So, okay, I get that. And so she goes to the Lady of the Lake and says, hey, can you help me kill my brother? Now, here's where I start not understanding it. So the Lady of the Lake says, have this sword. Because and it's relevant. The sword is relevant because the sword is this is the sword of fratricide, right? It's kind of like a cursed Dungeons and Dragons magical item, right? This is the sword of fratricide. If you draw this sword, then you are bound to the sword and you have to kill your own brother with it, right? It's a brother killing sword. So on the one hand, that seems relevant to the damsel who wants to kill her brother, right? Except the person who draws it will kill his brother, not her brother, right? So... Okay, but then of course we have to remember the other wrinkle, right? Which is that the Lady of the Lake hates this damsel. Remember, she came in asking for this damsel's head. So this woman, this damsel, right? It'd be nice if some of them had names. We'll call her the damsel. We'll call her the damsel, right? So the damsel comes to the Lady of the Lake and says, can you please help me kill off my... I want to bump off my brother. Can you help me? Lady of the Lake is looking at her saying, okay, this damsel, I hate this damsel and I want this damsel dead. So I'm going to give her this sword. I'm going to curse her with this sword. I'm going to appear to help her. In response to her request for help, I'm going to give her a cursed sword, a brother-killing sword. So I'm going to deceive her into thinking that this is going to help her accomplish her end, when in fact it's just going to get her into trouble. Right? And so maybe, because if she has this sword and somebody draws the sword out of the sheath and then that person kills his own brother, everybody's going to be upset and they're going to execute her. Is that the play? Is that what the Lady of the Lake is that her plan here? And so the damsel is, I think, She's trapped. Does she know that she's trapped? She is kind of cursed and is sort of being delivered from the curse, kind of. But Yeah, I don't know. Okay, Jennifer's saying that we could solve this problem if the damsel is Balin's sister. Okay, wait, hang on, I got a second. So who's the brother who killed her lover? Balin? Is Balin the brother in question? In which case, the sword is going to kill himself. Because Balin has a brother, right? He does, in fact, have a brother. Karina's wondering what happens if a guy draws the sword out of the sheath who doesn't have any siblings, right? What if an only child pulls the sword out of the sheath? To which, Karina, the answer is, well, obviously, he wouldn't be able to do that. Right. The magic of the thing would prevent an only child from drawing the sword out of the sheath. Okay. Morgan says this is like the ending of an Agatha Christie parody. Yeah. Ooh, Zachary, I like that theory. Zachary says that's why she wanted the sword back. She couldn't pull it out, but she wanted to use it to kill her own brother. Oh, I like that, Zachary. But Balin kept it, and now she's like, oops, but, you know, this means that you're gonna kill your brother. Maybe. I don't think that this damsel is related to Balin. I mean, it happens. I mean, sometimes, you know, knights will go off on their careers and they'll have little sisters that they don't recognize. It could happen to anybody, right? You could meet your sister later in life and, you know, end up killing her or marrying her or both. And, you know, like, it happens. And why am I talking about Turin again? But anyway, there's precedent for that. We will see that kind of thing happening on later on. But no. Balin is not her sister. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Anyway, it's complicated. But Zachary, I like your solution. She wants the sword, the brother killing sword, because that's her goal. Yeah. Okay. Whew. Karina says, make them siblings in the movie adaptation. Maybe. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Okay. All right. Anyway, let's move on. But notice, Merlin, Arthur's still furious at Balin, right? Balin is very, very low. His public opinion polls are low in Arthur's court right now, right? And Merlin comes in and is talking him up, right? It is that guy took the sword away, the brother-killing sword. He's now carrying the brother-killing sword, and this is going to be awful, right? And it's going to lead to his destruction, and that's a tragedy because there is no... I do not know his match now living, right? He is that guy who just left here is the best knight in the world right now, right? Sir Balin is tops, number one. He's not been tested so much yet, right? Although you notice he's killed at least two, assuming there were different guys, he's killed at least two other knights, right? He's met a certain amount of success on the battlefield already, even though he hasn't really established his reputation. But anyway, okay. Two knights and one woman. That's true. He's killed the Lady of the Lake, too. So it's all good. So, yes, Karina, exactly. Merlin's focus from the beginning is on his potential and the tragedy that is going to be the unfulfilled potential of Sir Balin. All right. Here's what it's like to be Sir Balin. So, remember, Balin leaves the court, and the son of the King of Ireland, Lancior, Sir Lancior, who is in Arthur's court, asks permission to go fight with Sir Balin to avenge Sir King Arthur, right? He just did you a despite in your court. We're not going to let that slide. I want to go and challenge him. And Arthur, who's still really mad at Balin, says, you go do that, right? Go ahead. Go challenge him, right? So here's Sir Balin going out, minding his own business, still thinking very well of King Arthur, trying to, he's brainstorming, how can I get back into Arthur's good books, right? Because King Arthur is the bomb, and I really want him to think well of me. What can I do to earn his respect? And then here comes a dude from Arthur's court up behind him, yelling at him from a mountaintop in the distance, right? And telling him to, and you know, Balin's like, I don't really want to fight with you, but I guess it looks like I have no choice. You're coming after me, so okay, let's do this. And they joust, and his lance goes into the knight's side and kills him instantly, right? Which was an accident, and he didn't even know it happened, right? He, you know, he lances him, and the guy goes down, and he wheels around and draws his sword. He's like, okay, let's keep going. Oops, he's dead, right? Didn't even know. Then he saw him lie as a dead corpse. That means corpse, of course. And he looked about him, and was ware of a damosel that come riding full fast as the horse might drive on a fire palfrey. And when she espied that Lancior was slain, she made sorrow out of measure and sighed, ah, Balin, 12 bodies thou hast slain in one heart, and 2 heritages in one body, and 12 souls thou hast lost. And therewith she took the sword from her love that lay dead, and fell to the ground in a swoon. And when she arose, she made great dole out of measure, which sorrow graved Balin passing sore. And he went unto her for to have ta'en the sword out of her hand. Her hand, but she held it so fast he might not tuck it out of her hand, but if he should have hurt her. And suddenly she set the pommel to the ground and rove herself throughout the body. Oh man, what a day he's having! Right? So here this guy comes and he challenges him and he's like, I guess I have to fight you. And then he kills him, right? Didn't even mean to kill him, right? And then this lady comes pelting up and is like, you've killed us! You killed my lover! And then she's like, and then she takes his sword and he's like, no, it's okay, lady. I'm trying to help you. I'm really sorry that you... Oh, no, no, give me the sword. You better... Right? And then he's like, ah! He didn't do anything wrong! Poor Sir Balin is really... He's trying to do everything right here. Right, he tried to warn the other dude off. I don't want to fight you, man. I don't want to hurt you accidentally. And then he kills him like it happens. Right, that's a contact sport. And then, and the lady, she's right there. And then as he's standing there, right? So you're Sir Balin standing there over the corpse, and the lady shows up, right? And the lady kills herself, and now he's standing there over both of their corpses, kind of shell-shocked, not knowing what to do. And then his brother comes riding up, right? And then King Mark comes riding up and is like, hey, let's build them a tomb right here. And then Merlin comes by. This, all of a sudden, this spot where Balin was standing over their corpses is like Penn Station in rush hour, right? Everybody is coming through there. I just absolutely love this. absolutely love this scene. You know, here's poor Balin. He's like, this looks bad. I'm having a horrible day. There's bodies everywhere. It's not my fault, man. Oh, man. Stephen says, suddenly Monty Python seems a much truer adaptation than I initially thought. Stephen, I should have mentioned at the very beginning, one of the rewards, one of the enduring rewards of reading Sir Thomas Malory is the quest for the Holy Grail will be 10 times as funny after you've read Sir Thomas Malory than it was before you did. It's a very good, a very close parody of Arthurian stuff. And the more you know about Arthurian literature, the funny that movie gets. Anyway, yeah. yes, this happens at the course roads, James. Oh boy, yeah, Arthur would love that one. Yana, we're kind of going to have to watch The Holy Grail together after this, I think. That's probably going to have to happen. But anyway, yeah. Okay. So here's how Sir Balin's life now goes, right? This stuff just happens where he goes, right? So his brother, Balan, shows up. And he's still carrying the head of the Lady of the Lake, right? So Balin is going to report. And anon, Balin told his brother, they're still standing over the corpses of the other two people, right? Told his brother of his adventure of the Sweard and of the death of the Lady of the Lock, and how King Arthur is displeased with him. Wherefore, he sent this knecht after me that lieth here dead, and the death of this damsel graveth me sore.
So doth it me, said Balin. But ye must tak the adventure that God will ordain you.
Again, the same philosophy, right? So doth it me, but ye must take the adventure that God will ordain you. This is what happened, right? Now, notice what Balin is talking about. You know, Balin before, right? And then I'm going to just call them Balin and Balan. So Balin, when he quoted that before about taking the adventure that God will ordain you, that God will ordain him, there was that conjunction with his decision, right? So we were talking about that before. Balan is not talking about that at all here. He is explicitly referring to their grief over the death of this misfortune just happened, right? I mean, poor Balin could not help it, right? He didn't know what was going to happen. He did everything he could to help the lady, right? And to prevent her. Again, look, notice the position he's put in. Either I have to hurt her, I have to overpower her and rip the sword out of her hands, right? So he's trying to be gentle with her. He's like, I don't want to hurt the lady. And then because he didn't rip the sword out of her hands, she kills herself with it, right? And so now he's like, oh, great. Now the death of this lady is on his conscience and it's grieving him sore, right? Sorely, that is a sore when used in that way is a very intensifying adverb, right? How much does it grieve you? It grieves you sore. Okay. And Balan, his brother says, you know, Balan, his brother says, so doth it me. But ye must take the adventure that God will ordain you. When Balan talks about it, it sounds much more clearly, we need to endure whatever comes, right? Like, just take what happens, man. There's nothing you can do about it, right? All you can do is take the adventure that God has ordained. And it looks like God dealt you a pretty bad hand today, right? What could he have done? Nothing. And yet, he's in this trouble. Creed says, is this like the family motto or something? Yeah, apparently they were read the same book as a kid. Korea is wondering when Balin tells the story, does he mention the hole? And she said, I'd killed the man I best loved. Oh, does he mention about how if he kept the sword, he's going to kill the man he loves best in the world? Yeah, I don't know if he mentions that to Balan or not. I bet he does. I would say he does. Yeah, yeah. Karina, yes, absolutely. I too now am picturing ye must take the adventure that God will ordain you as like cross-stitched in a frame on the wall of Balin and Balin's house, right? And I also, by the way, Karita, imagine that they have at least two brothers, like Balin and Balon, right? Surely the mother, like the parents made the complete set, right? You've got Balin and Balan and Balin and Balon and Balon, right? Probably, right? They probably have several other brothers. You must take the adventure that God will ordain you. Yeah, see, now I want that cross-stitched. I always want to see a graphic of what that would look like cross-stitched. absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, Xenia, they probably do have a cousin balloon. Yeah, that's totally different. Okay. let's keep going. So King Mark shows up. This is King Mark of Cornwall. He's going to be important later, right? And he's one who's like, hey, who's the dead people, right? And Balin tells him the story, and King Mark is like, that's awful tragical. Let's bury them, right? And so he makes this big tomb. The meanwhile, as this was a doing, that is the making of the tomb of the two lovers, in come Merlion to King Mark and saw all this doing.
Here shall be, said Merlin, in this same place, the greatest battle betwixt two knechtes that ever was or ever shall be, and the truest lovers, and yet none of him shall slay other. And there Merlin wrote Hiernamez upon the tomb with letters of gold that shall fight in that place, which Namez was Launcelot du Lac and Tristram's.
So he doesn't write on the tomb the names of the Lancear, I guess, and like girl are on, is also on the tomb. But he also writes, he graffitis their tomb with, here shall Sir Launcelot du Lac and Sir Tristram fight the greatest battle that ever two knights will fight against each other. Okay.
Thou art a marvelous man, said King Mark unto Merlin, that spakest of such marvels. Thou art a boisterous man, and an unlikely to tell of such deeds. What is thy name? Said King Mark.
At this time, said Merlin, I will not tell you. But at that time Sir Tristram's is talking with his sovereign laddie.
Spoilers, Merlin! Then shall ye hear and canoe my name, and at that time ye shall hear tidings that shall not please you.
Okay, so, spoilers. You know that story, right? Sir Tristan and Isolde is what he's talking about, right? Isolde is going to be Mark's queen. This hasn't happened yet. This is future tense. All of this is future tense, right? King Mark is going to eventually marry a damsel named Isolde, and he's going to have a knight in his court named Sir Tristram, and Sir Tristram is going to fall in love with Isolde, and they're going to have a thing, and the time will come when King Mark will take Sir Tristram with his sovereign laddie. Okay, so King Mark, when that happens, right, then on that day, you will hear and know my name. Okay, Merlin, thanks for that. Don't worry, we'll get plenty of Tristram and Isolde later on. Matt, I hadn't even thought of that. Holy cow. Matt says, is Isolde from Ireland in this version? If so, that would make her the sister of the knight in this tomb who was just killed. I totally didn't think of that. We'll have to remember if Lancear is involved. But he is, actually. Yeah. I'm pretty sure Ireland is still going to be involved in the Tristram and Isolde story. I'm trying to remember exactly how it... The Mallory version is not the most memorable version of the Tristram and Isolde story. It's not the greatest version of the Tristram and Isolde story in medieval literature. But yeah, we'll get there. Okay. So... Yeah. All right. So notice several things. What's Merlin doing? Merlin is going around the countryside, writing in gold letters the things that are going to happen in the future, right? In this place. So he's upgraded, right? He used to just be telling Arthur this, right? Saying things in the future tense. This thing is going to happen, FYI. Right now he's going and writing it in gold letters around. So the time will come when Lancelot and Tristram meet each other and they have their battle together, the greatest battle between two knights ever. And when they do, it's going to happen here. And probably after the battle, they're going to be like, oh, look, there's writing on that tomb that says Sir Lancelot du Lac and Sir Tristram are going to meet here and fight the greatest battle ever. Right. So the event is pre-glossed, right? Before it happens. This is what Merlin is doing. He's going around inserting spoilers into the English countryside. That's what he's doing here. Anyway, but now he's got some things to say to Sir Balin, too. This is the first time Merlin has met him in person. Okay, let's see. Balin, said Merlin. Thou hast done thyself great hurt that thou saved not this laddie that slew herself. For thou mightest have saved here, and thou hadst walled. Oh, man, the guilt trip, Merlin.
"By the faith of me body," said Balin, "I might not save her, for she slew herself suddenly." "Me repenteth it," said Merlin, "because of the death of that laddie, thou shalt strike a stroke most dolorous that ever man stroke, except the stroke of our Lord Jesu Christ. For thou shalt hurt the truest knecht and the man of most worship that now liveth. And through that stroke, three kingdoms shall be brought into great poverty, misery, and wretchedness 12 years. And the knecht shall not be whole of that wound many years." Then Merlin took his leave. Which means, so he's like, "I'm out, guys, right? I'm going to void. See you later." "Nay," said Balin, "not so, for and I wist thou said soth, I will do so perilous a deed that I will slay myself to make thee a liar." Therewith Merlin vanished away suddenly. Okay. So Balin says he would rather kill himself than do that, right? Maybe Balin needs to go back and review the cross ditch again, right? What about taking the aventure that God has ordained for you, Balin? That is not his reaction here, right? His reaction here is, "And I wist thou said soth." If I believed, if I knew that what you said was actually going to happen, I would kill myself to make you a liar. Which is, of course, a paradox, right? If I knew that you were telling me the truth, that this thing would definitely happen, then I would make you a liar by killing myself, which would mean that it wasn't true, which would mean that the premise of my killing myself didn't happen. But anyway. I don't understand. I don't understand the causal relationship here. Merlin says, because of the death of that lady, because you didn't prevent the death of that lady, you will strike the dolorous stroke. We get nothing else, right? We get nothing else. Ben says, "I thought Sir Balin was the greatest knight alive." He is now. Sir Lancelot's not alive yet. Sir Lancelot and Sir Tristram are in the next generation. Sir Balin is not going to live long enough to compete with Sir Lancelot. He's not. Sir Lancelot might be alive. He might still be in elementary school or something. But he's not a knight yet. He's not in circulation. Why is the death of this lady going to cause Balin to strike the dolorous stroke? Is it that this lady, had she lived, would have somehow done something to prevent the dolorous stroke? I don't know. We have no idea. But I guess, you know, we're not... Merlin is here to tell us what's gonna happen, not what might have been, I guess. More Merlin in a bit. More dolorous stroke in a bit. Okay. Merlin goes back to court and talks to Arthur. "Sir," said Merlin, "look ye keep well the scabbard of Excalibur, for ye shall lose no blood while ye have the scabbard upon you, though ye have as many wounds upon you as ye may have." So after, for great trust, Arthur betook the scabbard unto Morgan le Fay, his sister. Guess what could go wrong? And she loved another knecht better than her husband, King Uriens, other Arthur. And she would have had Arthur her brother slain, and therefore she let mak another scabbard for Excalibur like it by enchantment, and gaff the scabbard Excalibur to her lover. And the knecht's name was Accolon, that after had near slain King Arthur. But after this, Merlin told unto the King Arthur of the prophecy that there should be a great battle beside his Salisbury, and Mordred his own son should be against him. And he told him that Bagdemagus
By the way, Bagdemagus is my favorite knight's name. Of all of the names of all of the knights, Sir Bagdemagus is my favorite. That's not how you would probably really pronounce it, but that's how I always pronounced it. King Bagdemagus is my favorite. Sir Lacote Maltail is a close second, but Sir Bagdemagus, it's hard to beat that one. Was his cousin Germain and unto King Urien. So, by the way, Bagdemagus is your cousin. Mordred is going to fight a great battle with you beside Salisbury. So be on the lookout for that. Right. I do, Mike, I do like the fact that it sounds like his name is like Sir Bag of Mages, right? Korea says, I feel like there's a whole don't trust your sister subtext to this book. Yeah, Korea, we do have a certain fratricidal theme going on here during the tale of Sir Balin, don't we? And honestly, it almost seems like that's the primary reason that this bit about Morgan Le Fay is thrust into here. We're going to get this story. We're going to get the story of Arthur and Accolon and the whole business with the scabbard. And like, that's all going to come. He's going to tell us that story later. Carita, I do kind of suspect that it comes in here because of her fratricidal desires, right? It's kind of part of the theme. The Morgan Le Fay safe deposit service, I don't think it would have taken a genius to think that that was not a great idea, but it suggests the kind of relationship that Morgan Le Fay and Arthur had, or at least that he thinks they have, right? Having been impressed with the information that he must, above all things, keep the scabbard of Excalibur safe, he gives it to her to keep safe, right? So he obviously trusts her a lot. Cousin German doesn't mean your German cousins. Your cousin Germain. Oh, so let's see. I'm forgetting that it's a technical definition. It's a kind of cousin, and I'm gonna screw it up. I'll have to look up exactly what your cousin Germain means. It's a blood relation. But anyway, I forget. Dolorous Trek, it does start to sound like that, right? By the way, Bagdemagus is your cousin. You left the stove on. Your lost key is in your other pants. And by the way, your son is going to destroy your kingdom and kill you near Salisbury. Have a nice day. Yeah, Merlin gets into that mode, right? He's just going around telling everybody what's going to happen. Yeah, anyway. Okay, more on the scabbard later on. Sir Balin, here we go again. So, Sir Balin works his way back into Arthur's good graces by killing King Royans. Well, capturing him, right? So his great rival, he and Balan assault him at night, two on 40, right? Or 50 or so, and they kill 40 of them, and they capture King Royans, and they drag him, and they leave him in like a little basket on King Arthur's doorstep, right? And King Arthur's like, hey, how did you get captured? And he's like, I don't know, these two crazy brothers, you know, Balin and Balin captured me. So, and then Balin goes out and he kills, you know, he sides with King Arthur in the battle, and all of those kings, the 11 kings that were against him before, all die, and they're killed by Sir Balin, as Merlin predicted way back then. So all of this stuff. Okay, Matt, I thought so. Cousin German means first cousin. Yes, that's what I thought. Okay, good. Kit was saying the same thing. I knew it. It meant he's a close blood relation, but I wanted to make sure I didn't mess it up and give false information. Okay, so this story now comes in later. So we've reconciled with Arthur. Balin is reconciled with Arthur, and everything seems to be going swimmingly. And then Arthur is out hunting one day, and this knight rides by who is making great dole, right? He's clearly upset about something. And Arthur says, hey, knight, what's wrong? And the knight says, I don't want to tell you. And he keeps riding. And Arthur's upset that the knight didn't tell him what was wrong, right? So then Balin comes by. Be me head, said Arthur.
Ye be welcome. Sir, Rignew come riding this way, a kneeked mocking great moan, and for what cows I cannot tell. Wherefore, I will desire of you, of your courtesy and of your gentleness, to fetch again that kneeked, other be force, other by be his good will. Okay, so get him, drag him back here if you have to, but I want to know what's making him upset. I shall do more for your lordship than that, said Balin. Other Ellis, I will grieve him. And he will tell me what's wrong with him, or he'll pay for it. This kind of thing is hilarious. I just love this. Anyway, okay. So Balin rode more than a pass and found the kneeked with the damosel under a forest. That is next to a forest, right? Under the, like, by the edge of a forest. And sighed, Sir Kneeked, ye must come with me unto King Arthur for to tell him of your sorrow. That will he not, said the kneeked, for it will harm me greatly, and do you none avail. Sir, said Balin, I pray you make you ready, for ye must go with me, other else I must fight with you, and bring you by force. And that were me loath to do. Will ye be my warrant, said the kneeked, and I go with you? Ye, said Balin, other else by the faith of my body, I will die therefore. Now, by the way, so let's read between the lines here. I think there's a reason he didn't want to stop and tell Arthur what was wrong with him, right? And he is only agreeing to go. He says he won't go to Arthur because it will harm me greatly, right? It's not going to do you any good for me to do that. And it's going to harm me greatly if I do. And then he agrees to do it if Balin promises to be his warrant. Right, so if he promises him his safe conduct, so Balin will protect him. He will go there if he can go under Sir Balin's protection. I'm thinking what he has to say is going to severely displease Arthur. I think that he believes that if he told Arthur what he was moaning about, Arthur is going to be mad at him. Right, Arthur is going to attack him or something. I don't know what he's moaning about. We're never going to know what he was moaning about. But that kind of sounds like the situation, right? So here's Balin saying, notice the scrape that he's getting into already, right? He promised King Arthur that he would bring the guy back, and now he's bringing the guy back, but he's going to protect him. So what it looks like we're headed for, right, is one of those situations where the knight tells Arthur, and Arthur's like, this is the most untruest knight in the world, I want him killed, and Balin's like, but I promised to protect him, and Arthur's like, but you promised that you would do me more than, you know, you would do for me whatever I asked. When, you know, it looks like it's not going to end well. Not Balin's fault again, right? But we can see Balin getting trapped in a similar kind of cleft stick that Arthur was trapped in at the beginning before he was saved by decapitation. And indeed, Balin is about to be saved in a very similar way. And so he made him ready to go with Balin and left the damosel still. And as they were even before Arthur's pavilion, there came one invisible and smote the kneeked that went with Balin throughout the body with a spear. Alas, said the kneeked, I am slain under your conduit with a kneeked called Garlon. Therefore, tack me horse that is better than yours, and ride to the damosel, and follow the quest that I was in, as she will lead you, and revenge my death when ye may. Play.
Okay. So, Mike says maybe he doesn't want to tell Arthur there's an invisible knight riding around. Maybe, I don't know. But so here's this guy under Balin's protection, and while he's under Balin's protection, some dude just comes up and offs him, right? Just lightly stabs him through with his sword and takes off, right? Because apparently he can do this and be invisible. We don't know why he's invisible. We don't know how he's invisible. But Balin is pretty upset. And of course, we can see the irony here, right? We can see the sort of, I won't say poetic justice exactly, but anyway, we can see the parallelism, right? And certainly the kind of dramatic irony of Balin now being placed into the very position that he had been that he placed Arthur in, even down to the being freed from a potentially awkward situation by having somebody come and dishonorably kill the person that he was supposed to protect. Carita, it cracks me up too that he takes part of his dying breath to discuss the relative quality of their horse. That's my favorite. That are for talking to me, horse. That is better than yours. My horse is better than yours anyway, so take my horse. Okay. All right. But he does give him the information anyway about who the knight was called and everything. So here's poor Balin trying to do everything right, and now he's in trouble again. But now he's inherited this quest. We don't even know what the quest was. The knight didn't even get a chance to say what the quest was, but we know he had a good horse, and he knows the name of the invisible knight who killed him. Okay. And then this other knight. He meets this other knight, right? They like they look like they might fight, but then they decide not to fight. Ah, said the Knecht, is this all? Here I assure you, by the faith of my body, never to depart from you while my life lasteth. Ominous words said by the friend Perrin de Montbelliard. I'll never part from you for as long as I live. And so they went to their ostre and armed him, and so rode forth with Balin. And as they come by an hermitage, even by a churchyard, there come Garlon, invisible, and smote this Knecht, Perrin de Montbelliard, throughout the body with a glaive. Alas, said the Knecht, I am slain by this traitor Knecht that rideth invisible. Alas, said Balin, this is not the first despite that he hath done me. And there the hermit, and the hermit, there's a hermit who lives in the hermitage, right? The hermitage is a hermitage. Right? The hermitage is all over the place, and lots of friendly hermits. So an ostre means a hostelry, like the inn, the hotel that they were staying at, right? So they go back to their hostelry, and they arm them, and then they end up, right when he's in front of this hermitage, the invisible knight comes and skewers the guy. And so the hermit and Balin buried the Knecht under a rich stone and a tome royal. And on the morn they found letters of gold written, how that Sir Gawain shall revenge his father's death, King Lot, on King Pellinore. Merlin was here, right? More graffiti. You can't erect a tomb without Merlin coming by and putting some spoiler of future events in gold letters on it, right? Notice this isn't even relevant to the location. The other was at least a kind of coincidence, right? On this location, the two greatest knights and greatest lovers of all history are going to meet in the greatest battle that will ever be. Like, that's kind of, you want to put up a historical marker for that kind of thing, right? Usually you put up the historical marker after the event. Merlin does it in advance. That's fine. He has his own way, right? This is just like the tabloids, right? They wake up to find the message. Sir Gawain shall revenge his father's death on King Pellinore. Oh, okay, thanks for the tip. Right? All right, I guess. and see, the thing is, Merlin's not cryptic about these things. Right? I mean, the truth is out there, right? I mean, everywhere you go in England, you can see, like, by name and exactly what's going to happen. Like, does somebody read this and tell King Pellinore? Hey, by the way, King Pellinore, keep a sharp eye out for Sir Gawain, right? Because Merlin has intimated, like, I saw it written on this random tomb, right? That Sir Gawain is going to revenge his father's death by killing you. But I just, oh man, like, I shall never depart from you while my life lasts, and his life lasts like half an hour after that. Man, like, it's Balin, right? That's what it is to be Sir Balin, right? You meet your bestest friend, and he's gonna die. You barely even know him a day, right? And he's gonna get killed, and you're putting up a tomb that Merlin is gonna graffiti the next day. And now, so this invisible knight is out to get Balin, except he's not killing him, right? Presumably, going about invisible as he does, he could skewer Sir Balin anytime he wanted to, but he doesn't want to. Right? Instead, he wants to skewer the people with Balin and under Balin's protection. Okay. He's doing despite to Balin. Takako, that would be a really fun. It would be really fun to tour all of these places. Okay, we should probably stop here. What's coming up next? Okay, let's do one more and then we'll stop. So he's with the lady, right? The lady that was with the first dude that got killed, Sir Barius, I think his name was. The guy who he's escorting back to Arthur, and right when they get to Arthur's tent, it's the first guy the Invisible Knight kills. So his damsel, who's supposed to lead Sir Balin on the other dude's quest, that damsel. So he gets to this castle, and the portcullis drops between Balin and the damsel, so that the men of arms then surround the damsel out there. They separate her from his protection so that they can capture her and bring her in and bleed her, so they can fill a silver dish with her blood, because that's supposed to cure the lady of the castle. It's an old custom. They do this, right? They capture ladies, they bleed them. No hard feelings, I hope. But Balin, he's not going to put up with that, right? And Balin does this awesome stuff. They drop the portcullis and he can't get to them. And they explain about the custom, but he's not having it. So he runs into the tower, climbs up, jumps over the wall and down onto the other side and comes among them. And they explain, they're like, hey. And anon he pulled out his sword and would have folked in with them. And they all said, nay, they will not feast with him, for they did nothing but the old custom of this castle, and told him that here laddie was sick, and had lain many years, and she might not be whole, but if she had blood in a silver dish full of a clean maid and a king's doctor. And therefore the custom of this castle is, there shall be no damsel pass this, but she shall bled of her blood a silver dish full. Well, said Balin, she shall bleed as much as she may bleed, but I will not lose the life of her while my life lasteth. So you can bleed her. If she's willing, you can bleed her, but don't bleed her dry, right? And so Balin mad her to bleed by her good will, but her blood holp not the laddie, right? So her blood type was not a fit. Apparently it's not a transfusion. I don't know why she needs the blood. It's a curse. It's a disenchantment kind of thing. It's not. This is not like Dracula, right? It's not like that. And so she and he rested there all that night and had good cheer. I mean, good hosts, apart from the whole bleeding tradition. And in the morning they pass it on their wise, and as hit telleth after in the Sangreal, that Sir Percival, his sister, holp that laddie with her blood, whereof she was deed. Later on, in the quest for the Sangreal, in the quest for the Holy Grail, Sir Percival's sister is going to be the one who's going to fulfill this, and she is going to bleed the dish full of blood. She is going to bleed all of her blood and die. But she's going to cure the lady with her blood. She is the prophesied lady who is going to heal this other woman. Spoilers, narrator! Right, notice the narrator is doing exactly the same thing that Merlin is doing. Merlin's going around doing it in gold letters on tombs. The narrator is dropping this stuff in the middle of random paragraphs, right? So nothing comes of this immediately, right? This turns out to be irrelevant to the story of Balin. But we're introduced to the fact that there's this lady in this castle who needs a damsel's blood in order to cure her, and that that's going to be important later on. And we're told exactly how and why. The entire end of that story is spoiled for us, right? Sir Percival's sister is going to be the one, and it's going to kill her. So don't be surprised when that happens. Mike says, did Merlin write this? Well, yeah, yeah. Stephen, yes, they do that with every maid who passes that way, hoping that one of them ends up being a king's daughter. And a clean maid, by the way. That means she has to be a virgin. Clean maid, that's what that means. So hopefully she is a virginal king's daughter. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because you got to rule that out. Now, one thing, like, I keep complaining about spoilers. Spoilers are for people who like to be surprised, and that is not medieval readers. Medieval readers prefer to know how the story is going to end in advance. So that's one factor here. Another factor here. None of these stories are surprises, right? I mean, Mowry's not making any of this stuff up. It's not like, you know, when he spills the beans about Mordred and the Battle of Salisbury Plain, he's telling you anything you don't already know. Everybody knows that. It's Caxton's title, Le Mort d'Arthur, right? But when you start talking about the death of Arthur, everybody knows, A, that Arthur is going to die, and B, how Arthur's going to die. It's very famous. There have already been many stories and poems called the Mort d'Arthur, right? The death of Arthur is a famous thing. So it's not exactly spoilers, in a sense. It's like what we're getting are these references to all of the stories that Mowry is drawing from, right? All of these things are kind of percolating in and coming together, and we're still sort of seeing, like, the outlining form of this, right? Like, all of these scraps of stories are here, and Mowry keeps bringing them up, right? So that we can know these are being sorted out. These are all going to come together later on, right? And yes, we do see Merlin. Notice how Merlin and the narrator, how, just like I was saying from that first slide, how similar are their roles here. And they're like doing competing spoilers. The narrator placing them, the references throughout the story. This is going to be important later for this reason. We're going to come back to this at another point here. This is from that other story, the story of Accolon and Arthur, which we'll get to pretty soon, but it's not time for that yet. And all of these Quest for the Holy Grail references that we keep getting, right, that we're actively preparing for. This story is setting the scene for the story of the Quest for the Holy Grail in a bunch of ways, in a bunch of really important ways. There's a lot of pretty intimate connections between the story of Sir Balin and the story of the Holy Grail, it will turn out. Okay. Let's stop there. So we'll stop there. We'll finish the story of Balin next time. We still have quite a bit, but we'll finish that and we'll continue forward. I don't think we'll get through everything that I had planned for the next class, but we will do some of it. So keep reading. This has been a lot of fun, though. I don't want to lose any of the story of Sir Balin, though. I mean, I already skipped a whole bunch, right? I skipped about how he captures King Royans, and I captured how the death of King Lot, right, and all that stuff. But exactly, Ryan. You may also have heard of Percival's story, but you may not have known that it's connected to this story, right? Yeah, what we're getting here is the story behind this. Of course you've heard, you know about Sir Percival. You might even have heard the story of Sir Percival's sister, right? But did you know that, like, these are the roots of it, right? This is how it all fits together. This is where it came from. That's the work that Mowry is doing. He's not inventing any of this stuff, right? But what he is doing the biggest, coolest compilation of all of them. And he's making the connections. And when he's doing it here, it's super crude, right? He's just kind of roping it together and making all these references and allusions. And Merlin is out there painting gold letters on tombs. He's going to get better. Mowry's going to get better as a storyteller. But it's really fun to see, like, what he's setting out to doing. What he's setting out to do, right, as he's moving forward. All right. I'll let you guys go. It's late. We'll finish Sir Balin next week. Look forward to seeing some of you in the Bay Area this coming weekend. I will see everybody else next Wednesday for our next class. Thanks for joining me, everybody. Bye now.